Welcome to episode 7 of the Skip to the End podcast. As ever, I'm Ben.
I'm Mark.
I'm Adam.
And on this week's edition of the podcast, we're going to be reviewing Interstellar, the new film from Christopher Nolan. We're going to be discussing the scariest horror films of all time, as well as thinking about great performances in otherwise terrible movies, and various other things that will come up as we go along. We also have a brand new website, skiptotheend.co.uk. It's an archive of all our previous episodes. You'll also be able to look at all the top 3 and top 5 lists that we've done. You'll be able to see a bit of a roundup of all the reviews that we've done. And also, more importantly, it's going to be a source of articles that we're going to write. We're going to try and update the site at least once every other day with maybe news items, maybe reviews of films that we've seen that we didn't have time to discuss on the podcast, or maybe to expand on things that we did discuss. But check it out. That's skiptotheend.co.uk.
Following on from last week, we had the task of setting ourselves the top horrors of all time, in our opinion. Now, I know this is my favourite genre and you two aren't as keen, so it's a bit more challenging for you guys, but...
Well, Ben didn't, did he? Ben was coming up with films that didn't scare him.
Well, yeah, because I'm an
overrated
adult.
Overrated horrors.
Yeah, I'm an adult, so these things don't scare me.
Well, unless it's like a film of a fridge that never had beer in it.
that is terrifying.
So, Adam, do you want to start with your first choice?
Well, I'll go with... Not necessarily a horror film, it's more of a film that... I'm not really a fan of the horror genre per se. I prefer things that are tense and, you know, it's suspenseful. So psychological thrillers, things like that. So I'll start off with The Woman in Black.
Terrible film, in my opinion.
Which is fine. It is a bit kind of light. I think it was actually released as a 12A or something like that.
Was this the Daniel Radcliffe film?
Yeah, it was, yeah. It's quite a tense film, and that's what kind of gets me. I don't really like long... sequences where you think something's going to happen, you keep thinking something. That's what makes me jump. So I've gone with that because there's a few scenes in there which is just made me jump in the cinema, really, I guess. There's one where Daniel Radcliffe, he's looking out the window.
Yeah.
And he kind of sees his rocking chair rocking and then lightning flashes and all of a sudden this image in the window appears behind him and screams. That made me jump.
This, having... Now, I don't really know much about horror films, as we've said, but having this in your top three horrors... is like having Dracula Untold in your top three films of all time.
Yeah.
It's a terrible choice.
Well, I don't really watch many horrors, I
guess.
Fair
enough.
And the ones I do watch don't scare me, because as you said, you're an adult.
Yeah.
This is more of a psychological thing, I think.
That's fair enough, and if it's what scares you, then that's good to bring it, it's good you have an opinion.
Thanks a lot, I appreciate that.
That's really nice of you to say that. Yeah. It's good that he's got an opinion.
Well, this is my last podcast.
So, Ben, I know you've struggled with this.
I have struggled with it, but my first one is a film that genuinely did scare me because I saw it when I was a child. It.
That is a great film.
That was, and was it Pennywise, the name of the clown? Pennywise the clown was bloody terrifying.
Yeah.
And I don't like clowns, full stop.
Everyone I know who hates clowns now... hate them because they watched It when they were younger.
Yeah, and I think that probably makes sense for people of our generation.
Not
that
everyone. My mate John doesn't like them because one of them tried to... Stephen King novel, so yeah, really scary.
Yeah, but I think it is true that people of our generation, that was one of the first sort of evil clowns we had any experience of, so it's not surprising that a lot of people around our age are terrified of clowns.
Yeah, I mean, just pick up on something Mark said there, Stephen King novel, brilliant. So, but I've watched quite a lot of films based on his work, and I rarely find them scary.
Yeah, he's all about the characters and building up the...
Don't get me wrong, they're always good films.
Yeah,
it's just scary isn't really something I generally associate with them. Stuff like Misery, the scary moments. Carrie, the scary moments, but it's not really a scary film.
Have you seen the film The Mist?
I've not actually, no.
Really, now, I'm going to set it for your homework because it's one of the bleakest, brilliant films. And a few people, when I've been having this conversation this week about what's your scariest film and stuff, they said it isn't the scariest, but one that's left me kind of... with the chills,
Are there two versions, or is there just one film?
There's one, but the director, the same guy that did Shawshank, what's his name?
Frank Darabont.
Yeah, he insisted that he'd like it shown in black and white. That's how he wanted it to be shown to the public. they went against that and released it in colour. But on the Blu-ray or DVD, you can get the option to watch it how he intended.
I'm quite a big fan of Frank Darabont anyway, so no, I'm actually very excited to watch that then. I'll take that as homework.
That's a good bit of homework
it's,
for
it's
you.
It's an unbelievable film, and as you know, I'm a massive fan of that movie.
Excellent.
What's your first choice then, Mark?
I'm going to go with Jaws, for the fact it's terrifying. I watched it probably 20 years ago. I was probably about 12. It made me never want to go in the sea again. Yeah. I used to go on a family holiday to Barmouth with my mum and dad every year. Since seeing that film, I would never go back in the sea. I was terrified. Now, obviously, it's different. I don't go on holiday with my parents. But, yeah, it's a brilliant movie.
Would
that's...
you go in the sea now?
What, with my parents?
Budgie smugglers. No.
I would go in the sea now, but it did terrify me. You know, it's like your imagination at that age. You did think that great white was going to be in Barmouth, and that film's a masterpiece.
I've never seen it.
See, I don't want you to admit this on the podcast because you're going to get absolutely crucified.
I don't care if I get crucified.
Would you want that as homework for the fact
that... Yeah, no, I absolutely think I should, because it's a film... again, it sums up what this whole homework thing was originally. Yeah. It's films that everyone else has seen that you haven't, so fine. I will watch Jaws.
Brilliant.
Well, don't sound too enthusiastic about it then.
I think you'll enjoy it. It's a, it, you know,
you said this about Indiana Jones.
Yeah, you know the respect that gets. Yeah. And the fact that it's one of Spielberg's first ever films, and it had so many delays, it had so much production problems. And when you watch it, you'll still appreciate it now and think that is a really well made. And you see the potential he has.
And in all fairness, I don't know about you, Mark, but when someone gets set homework in a film that I've already seen, I do tend to watch it myself that week anyway. So any excuse to rewatch Jaws.
So maybe better watch The Mist if you get time as well, because that's a really good one to talk about. The ending is exceptional.
That's two pieces of homework set already.
Yeah.
In the first 5 minutes, done. So, Adam.
Okay, I'm going to go with my other choice, which is One Hour Photo.
Wow.
Okay, not a horror, but a very
tense... Again, it's a very tense psychological thriller, and we've spoken at length about Robin Williams.
We have.
And some of his more serious, dramatic performances, and this is one of the best.
Yeah, I mean, agreed. Mm-hmm.
His performance in this film, I think one of us actually raised it at the time.
Yeah, I think it was me.
He's just so, so creepy.
Yep.
And it's just utterly brilliant.
Well, the thing is, the homework's a horror or a film that really scared you, and
that was one that really scared me. And I think with this film, the thing that kind of frightened me about it is there was nothing supernatural about it. This was a story that you could quite easily read about in the papers.
Yeah.
This is a person who idolises a family, and that's what he wants. He wants to be part of that family and starts putting himself into that, but then he starts getting too involved. And this is what kind of frightened me about it, because this is something that could happen to you in real life. This isn't like Paranormal Activity.
No.
I point blank don't believe in ghosts. It's not something I believe in.
Mm.
So I'm not frightened by that kind of aspect. But with this, it generally frightens me because it could happen.
Do you know what I think scared me about... Well, it was a bit of an eye-opener for that film, is the fact that he hadn't done... I always associate him as Mrs. Doubtfire, Hook. You know, he was always the happy, enjoyable... Pretty much, not. I wouldn't say he's always the same type of character, but you never really see him in a bleak, miserable, depressed state.
Yeah.
And then in that film was the first time you saw it, and you were like, this is absolutely harrowing, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, and it just leaves you cold. There was something I was actually reading about when I researched, this is quite interesting, kind of a bit of a hark back to our two casts ago. Trent Reznor actually did the original score for this film.
Oh, did he?
But it was dropped. They decided not to go with it.
Not too bleak.
I don't know, but they decided not to go with it. And
too upbeat.
He actually ended up releasing a lot of that material on Nine Inch Nails' next album.
I did not know that. I like that fact.
Yeah. So
you learn something new from every episode. Mm-hmm. So, Ben, is it you?
Yeah. Now that I've already exhausted my full list of films that scared me, my last two picks are just two horror films that I actually saw at the cinema. And by God, I wish I hadn't. One of them was the 2003 remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Dreadful.
Yeah. It is an atrocious film. It's not in any way scary. It's yet another pointless Hollywood remake.
Was that not a comedy?
It was funny, but not for the reasons you would expect. One of the reasons why it came to my mind is because I was at university at the time and I went to see this, and I went with a few uni mates. And I don't know if you remember the film, but at the start of it, there's a bit where it's supposed to be documentary footage. And they're going down into the basement in, like, this slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, shaky cam documentary footage. And then, you know, Leatherface or whoever jumps out. At the end of the film, when the credits rolled, my friend Frank was sitting next to me and he turned to me and went, I don't think that was real footage, you know. Who did?
Do you still speak to him now?
No, he's dead to me. It's his birthday today, actually. Happy birthday, Frank.
Yeah.
Go on then, Mark.
Next for me, I've got to look at a film that... I've got to go back to my childhood, because that's when I was more scared. Like you said, nothing really scares you now. My parents were very big on not letting me watch films that were 18 or 15 if I was only 11 or 12. Okay. And they always used to talk about this horror video that Dad had that he would watch when I wasn't around. And I was like, what is this horror? I was thinking, is it actually just some... porno you that are talking about, and you know, it was kept upstairs under your dad's bed. I was thinking, if I find this, it's probably going to be something, you know, degrading. But instead, I went upstairs.
Were you thinking you might find a sex tape?
Well, not their sex tape. No,
oh,
no. Oh, grim. That would be the scariest.
That would be horrifying, wouldn't it?
So eventually, my mum and dad went away, and I went to stay at my friend's house, but they left me a key. So I went upstairs and I found Poltergeist on VHS. And I remember it was very strict, never watch this, it's terrifying, you shouldn't watch this. So me and my friend Ben went straight back to his house with the video, put it in, and I won't lie to you, it terrified me. The voice of Carolyn. Have you seen the film?
Yeah.
Horrible. Yeah, you watch it now and you just think this is more of a comedy and a bit more of a jokey film. But it was absolutely terrifying.
It is quite a terrifying film for a child to watch.
Yeah.
I was 12. So, you know, was it the first time you realised that your parents knew what they were talking about?
A little bit, yeah. But the do not watch it, you know, big mark, no.
Did you ever disobey your parents again?
Many times. But
what I want to know is, under this like stash of goodies under their bed, was there anything else? Or was it just this one tape?
No, there was lots of films under there that were 18, just violent films, lots of Chuck Norris films, stuff like that were just really violent, you know, Kickbox, all that sort of stuff that they didn't want me to watch. But my dad would sometimes let me watch it when mum was out. But yeah, that's one of those films that now I watch it, I think, what was I scared of this for? But I'll admit it was scary.
I think that's a big part of it. When you're a kid, I think things are a lot scarier than when you're an adult, as Ben alluded to at the start of it. Unfortunately, Ben's always had the mind of a 31-year-old man.
That's true, yeah.
So I don't think even as a kid you were that scared by most of it.
So that was my second choice.
Excellent. So back round to me then. I'm going to choose the film that it might not scare me as much, but I like. And again, as a kid, I found it absolutely frightening when I first saw it. Nightmare on Elm Street.
The original. Yeah.
I remember watching it for the first time. I think I must have been about 12. And I didn't want to sleep ever again. I just had this crazy fear that Freddy Krueger was going to come and kill me, basically, in my sleep. I've since then got over it by seeing a picture of Jessica Nigri dressed as Freddy Krueger, which was incredible.
And if you don't know who Jessica Nigri is, Google that.
Because you will not be disappointed.
I always forget Johnny Depp's in that film.
Is he?
Yeah. He's the young lad on the bed, and he's literally about 5.
Yeah.
Do you know what? The thing that's always diluted that film, other than the 4,000 sequels, is that, is it Robert England who played
him?
Yeah, Robert. He's done so many sort of shoddy horror films since then, or comedy films where he's playing a horrific character, and he's just sort of lived off that legacy, and it's really diluted it for me.
It's one of the things where Robert England was fantastic as Freddy Krueger. There was this hilarious comedic side to it as well, which, looking back as an adult, you find quite sickeningly funny, I guess. He's just got this way with words, and his comedic portrayal is actually quite good. They actually remade Nightmare on Elm Street, and it was an absolute cockstain of a film. But Jackie O'Haley, who plays Rorschach in Watchmen, plays Krueger. And although the look of Krueger is terrible, he portrays this more kind of villainous side of Krueger, I guess. No, the comedy element's completely gone.
Right.
And it's more about the fact that he is killing people. And they allude to it in the original film that he was a bit of a child molester as well.
A bit of a one.
But they basically end up going down the route that he killed children, he didn't molest them. Whereas in this one, they actually go down the full route of him touching kids, which just adds that other sinister element to it as well. And Jackie O'Haley kind of portrays it in a brilliant way, I guess.
He also played a paedophile in Little Children. He's getting typecast, is Jackie.
That'll be my last one.
Good choice. Impressed.
My final one, then, again, much like the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, is another film that I saw at the cinema, and it was an absolute disaster piece. This film, it came out, I was at school at the time, it came out on Halloween, and it had been put out reviewed as the scariest horror film of all time.
I know what you're
going to
say.
So me and a few friends went to see this on Halloween, a 12 midnight showing. We were ready to be petrified. And I wasn't petrified because it was the Blair Witch Project, and it, not only was it the least scary horror film I've ever seen, it was one of the worst films I've ever seen. All that happens is that some trees rustle.
Spoilers.
Then you see some twigs.
Spoiler.
And then it just kind of ends.
Spoiler.
And I was thinking, so what was the scary bit?
What's outside the tent? Is that a napkin? Don't open it. Oh, there's a bit of a Kit Kat.
Yeah. It is a dreadful film. I don't know why people loved it so much.
I just remember it being kind of held up as something completely original and different. It was all that found footage. I think it's
to be fair, it wasn't the first cam films, was it? Yeah. I know they've got loads now, but it was the first one where they, I suppose that was original.
Yeah.
It's just to advertise it as a horror film when, I mean, I've watched it myself and it's probably, I think Ben's summary of it was perfect. Here's a twig, here's some leaves rustling,
yeah.
There's a napkin, and, yeah. And oh, look, no, end.
The bit where that lass is crying into the camera and she's getting all bunged up, that was the scariest bit in the film for me. I get some makeup on, love.
The best thing that came out of that film was the Scranton Witch Project. Michael Scott's,
well, at least we can be grateful for that.
Video. That's all of them. Then have we got any coming from the social media?
Yeah, don't worry about my number one.
I might be sure, all right.
Don't worry, Adam. Yeah. Cheers.
Getting all big now that he's been entitled to an opinion.
So my number one choice is The Thing.
Standard.
John Carpenter. The greatest horror of all time. I'm not going to babble on about it. I do it most weeks. Just go and watch it if you haven't seen it. It's the greatest horror ever made.
Simple as that.
No, I'm not going to talk about it. It's that good.
You did actually speak about it slightly.
I think I talked about the famous
directors, didn't you?
Yeah, and also my favourite film. Yeah. And
just any
soundtrack.
Excuse to bring it up, really.
Fair enough. It's like The Dark Knight.
I have to give credit to Halloween, the original. The Descent. Have any of you seen that?
Is it the one where they came?
That was pretty scary. The Orphanage. Which is a really good film if you get a chance to see it.
Guillermo del Toro one.
It's a brilliant film and the sound on it's fantastic. And Alien and Aliens are terrifying.
I can't believe no one's mentioned The Matrix 3. That was the most horrific film I've ever seen.
Good point.
I just want to talk briefly about horror films recently and how they've kind of declined quite heavily. And I was reading about an article about this the other week and it made some very good points. I think with the rise in horror video games, survival horror, you've seen a lot more scary games coming out as opposed to scary films.
So since sort of the first Resident Evil.
Exactly,
and so on.
Yeah. And I think because you invest yourself in a character when you're playing through a game, you kind of have this connection to them. And now in horror films, it's a connection that you don't have.
Yeah.
I think most people now go and see horror films like Saw because they want to see the more violent side.
Yeah,
of
it's
it,
the blood and guts.
Rather than the tense side. And I think Alien Isolation, a game that came out recently, has kind of showed the gulf in class between a scary film and a scary game nowadays.
That's a good point. Mark, so have we had any suggestions come in through the social media?
Yeah, through Facebook, which is facebook.com/skip-to-the-end-podcast. We've had Adam Rogers with The Shining.
Yep.
Goes without saying. Mm-hmm. Richard Booth, A Tale of Two Sisters. Terrifying film.
Never heard of it.
Needed new pants. Brent Davis, Exorcist and Dawn of the Dead, the original.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Ian Evans agrees with you. So it says it's messed him up for life and he's had to put the DVD in the fridge after watching it. So I don't know what that would
be. Is that a Friends reference by any chance?
I have no idea.
Is that what Joey did with Cujo?
Cujo in
there. Stuart Pickering has put Alien and Zombie Flesh Eaters. Ian Pollock has put that he could never watch The Exorcist growing up, terrified him, and even now he still thinks it's scary in a religious way. We've had Steve Buen, who has put the uncut Exorcist, including the crab walk down the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of Exorcist fans, yeah.
A lot. Lois Netting Alexander has put The Ring, even the remake isn't bad. The Mothman Prophecies, I've not seen that, I don't think.
Is that the Richard Gere thing?
Yeah, I think so.
It might be, yeah.
And not sure it's horror, but Old Boy scared her in a big way.
It's an amazing film.
Yeah.
Not a scary one.
Tony Ridley, The Wizard of Oz.
Right.
Why? It's a kid's film.
Yeah, but The Lion, I suppose, could be quite scary.
The monkeys were quite scary.
Ben Sinclair McDonald, Let the Right One In. Incredible film.
Great film.
Absolutely.
Brilliant book as well.
And Joe Crook, Halloween. And a shout out to my mum, who's actually commented, and put, I Spit on Your Grave, the very first and last horror I'll ever watch.
Wow. Yeah.
So my dad must have literally put that on, and that's a horrible film. The rape scene in that is horrific, so I don't know why. I really don't know why they've sat and watched that. I'm a bit disturbed, but yeah. So that's our horror special.
Excellent.
I've had an idea for next week's topic. What do you guys think to your top three animated films of all time?
Not easy.
Yeah, not easy at all.
It's because it's a broad topic. Because I don't necessarily mean sort of kids animated Pixar films.
No, you don't mean Pixar,
films.
You don't mean Dream.
You know,
you mean
we've
like
been talking about
Japanese
anime
as well.
Exactly, yeah.
Some great choices. I mean, Howl's Moving Castle, things that Spirited Away.
Hang on, I'm back.
I'm just talking. I mean, that's a very broad topic. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, it's going to bring up all your kids' ones as well, isn't it? All the Transform. Oh my God, my brain's going. Yeah. Accepted. Right. That's going to be great fun.
Next week, top three animated movies. We've been to see Interstellar, the brand new film directed by Christopher Nolan, written by himself and his brother Jonathan Nolan. It's a sci-fi film, and it tells the story of an Earth set in the near future where resources are at a minimum. There's barely any food. The only real food remaining to people is corn. The Earth is covered by a huge dust cloud, and basically extinction is imminent. So it's about a mission to space to try and find new habitable planets. That really is the basic framing device of the film, but there's a lot more to it than that. To give you a warning, there will be major spoilers here. There's no way we can discuss the film without going into the ending and various other spoiler-filled elements. So, Adam, initial thoughts?
It's a difficult film to kind of sum up. There's a lot to it. It's about 2.5 hours anyway, which naturally means there's quite a lot to talk about. This is kind of the first part of the story. Then there's this bulk of space travel in the middle, and then towards the end, what I like to call frothy nonsense.
Yeah, I would second that. There was a lot of frothy nonsense.
Yeah, so it's very difficult to just sum up my thoughts, I suppose, in one fell swoop.
Yeah.
Underwhelmed, I think, is the word I'd use.
I would second that as well. Mark, what about you?
I really just feel really kind of let down and disappointed. I blame myself as well for having such high expectations on this film.
Yeah.
I seem to always forget that directors can have a bad film or not always be consistently incredible. And for me, I just feel flat and like very, very disappointed, like someone's cheated on me. I've been saying to you both and Adam and anyone that knows me how excited I have been for this film. I've built it up more than Star Wars for you, Adam, and, you know, for them to announce a new V for Vendetta film for you, Ben, something like that. You know, if the anticipation for this film was massive and...
In all fairness, I'd just like to say, if they announce a new V for Vendetta film, I wouldn't be that excited to see that.
But I'm very, 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 very disappointed.
Although a sequel to that would be better than Interstellar, I think.
Well, potentially.
To pick up on your frothy nonsense line there, Adam, I agree. I think, for me, the film was split into three sections. The first section was the stuff on Earth where Matthew McConaughey, playing Cooper, is a farmer. It's about him and his family and about how he's drawn into returning to NASA, who he used to work for, to pilot this space mission. So there's all this sort of family farm-based stuff that is deathly boring.
Necessary
to set the stage, but deathly boring. The middle third of the film is the space exploration itself, which we're going to get into more detail in shortly. And then the final third of the film is the closing. That's all a bit too lovey-dovey.
Yeah,
not enough sci-fi for me. A bit too saccharine. A bit too sweet. Frothy nonsense.
Especially for a film that sells itself on being a sci-fi epic.
Yeah,
there was no real. And I kind of I've spoke about it briefly with other people as well as you guys, I think. But there was, for a sci-fi film, there was just no peril.
Yeah,
there didn't really appear to be, as much as the extinction of man appeared to be imminent. We were jumping forward 20-odd years and they were still on Earth, still around. It just didn't seem like it was imminent. There just seemed to be no immediate danger to anyone.
Yeah. There's a bit towards the middle of the film where Matthew McConaughey and his team, including Anne Hathaway, they've landed on a planet, I think it's off Jupiter or something like that that they think might be habitable and able to be colonised. And then it turns out they run into a previous NASA astronaut played by Matt Damon, and he has ulterior motives and he has a bit of a fight with McConaughey. And that's the closest thing to peril that you see in the film, yeah. This 2-minute fist fight. And it wasn't enough.
Yeah, I mean, he's been stuck. He's called Dr. Man. He's been stuck on this planet for years, basically, yeah. In hypersleep. He sent stats up saying that the planet was habitable. It wasn't habitable. He just wanted to find a way off it so he could see human beings again, which I'm sure is something you can kind of understand if you can wrap your head around kind of being alone for that long. So that's the only real peril there is when he finds out that Cooper is planning to go back to Earth and use the only spacecraft to do that. He knows the planet isn't habitable, so he tries to actually kill Cooper to stop him getting off the planet. But that's the only real sense of danger I think you get out of this film. Even though during parts of this film they're flying perilously close to black holes that don't appear to be any sort of danger to them because they're slingshotting around them like they're nothing.
Yeah.
There is just no sense of danger.
No, and the supposed story is that the people on Earth are going to perish, and it's how do we save the citizens of Earth. But it really came down to one small story about the love between a father and his daughter.
Yeah.
And that's lovely, that's fine if that's what you go into the cinema to see. That's not what I thought we were going to see. No. I thought we were going to see this sci-fi epic.
I mean, I think if I watched it again with a different opinion going into it, I might enjoy it a bit more because I know what to expect this time round. But as a film that's kind of originally, well, it seemed to be sold on nothing originally. We just got a few trailers that didn't really tell you anything about the story. But then there was this one trailer that came out. It was like, okay, this is going to be epic. It's a big sci-fi adventure. And it just didn't seem to be that.
The one good thing about this movie for us, we saw it on the opening night, so we didn't have any spoilers. We didn't go in there with pretty much any indication of what was going to happen. It would be easy to now go online and have a lot ruined for you. I didn't know Matt Damon was in the film, so that was quite pleasant to see. I didn't know anything about the story. I didn't know anything about pretty much any of it. But there was no massive shocks or massive storylines that really made me care that I hadn't read about it now. And I think anyone going to the cinema, even if you listen to this, it's not going to spoil it for you, because there's no major twists or major points where you're like, oh my God. And we won't talk about the ending yet, but that's the only bit I suppose we didn't see coming.
Let's touch upon the story a bit.
Or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof. Ben, you've kind of broke the film down into sections there. It's a very accurate summary about the first part being the love between the father and the daughter, the family. Yeah. It is boring, it is necessary. We need to understand a bit more about why they're planning to leave the Earth, what it is on Earth that's making the human race extinct. Mm-hmm. And one thing that kind of got me was, there was one kind of throwaway line from Cooper in the film where he talks about people dropping bombs on the population to try and curb how many human beings there are on the planet.
Yeah.
And then that's never touched upon again.
Yeah.
We never really see that, you know, the government were responsible for essentially what was mass genocide.
Mm-hmm. There are a few things like that, actually, where they drop things in that should have been explored further and weren't. There's a bit where Matthew McConaughey Cooper goes to his daughter Murph's school. She's had a bad report. She got into an argument with some kids at school because she'd been talking to them about the original Apollo moon missions.
The moon landing, yeah.
And apparently now the new textbooks at this point in time on Earth have denied the moon missions. They've said that they're a hoax. And it's like, okay, that's quite an interesting thing, but can we have a bit more backstory on that? Why is it that NASA are the bad guy?
Yeah.
Give us a bit more on that.
And we never understood that. I mean, Michael Caine's character, Professor Brand, also kind of touches on it a bit by saying that NASA are now working in secret because with the amount of resources left on the planet, the general public would be horrified to find out they were still funding space travel. But it just, again, it wasn't really explained.
And again, that to me was a plot hole, or not necessarily a plot hole, just bad writing. If the writing is, if what we're told is, NASA operates in secret because the public would be horrified that what limited resources they have are going on space exploration, that doesn't ring true to me. If everyone on Earth is going to die, and the only hope for salvation is to leave Earth, then put all your money into space exploration. Surely people would vote for that.
I assume that the world doesn't know it's ending. I assume they've kept that secret as well. But again,
I think if all the people are dying and the only crop they have is corn, I think they know.
But I think they just still feel the government's working on a solution to that. I don't know. It's not explained.
There wasn't enough explained.
That's the problem.
That's the point, yeah. It's not explained.
What I didn't like as well is we had kind of a probably 40 minutes of the backstory of his love for his daughter, the way he would go out, the farming and everything. Then when he finally comes upon finding all out about NASA, they're then told that he is the only person that would really want to fly and do this mission. That's the one guy they want to do it. So he goes back to see his daughter. There's about a 10-second segment of him going in, cuddling up to her and saying, I've got to go now.
Don't go, Daddy.
Yeah, and that's it. And then literally, within 2 minutes, he's in space.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, considering this is a massive film about this mission, and, you know, I don't want to compare it too much to films like Gravity and Armageddon and other, you know, Contact and stuff, but those films, you do see the launch, you see the anticipation, the... oh my God, these people are going to get the opportunity to go into space. And literally, I blinked, and he was in space, and everything was normal. Like, oh, we're in space now. Anne Hathaway was there going, you know, this is pretty cool, isn't it? You know, and I was like,
I think
you've just got to space in 10 seconds.
I think this is one of the key points, because that happened so quickly, and they built upon the relationship between Cooper and his daughter, Merv, quite a bit to start with, and then kind of left it again. When he does go down to this planet that's orbiting... a black hole, in a sense, so time runs differently. So I think they estimate that 1 hour is 7 years.
Yeah.
So Cooper says, well, we can't spend too long down there because otherwise there'll be no one on Earth left to save. So they go down there, they end up spending about 1 hour and 10 minutes, something like that, an hour and quite a bit of time down there just reflooding these engines because a big wave crashes over the rocket, which means the engines get flooded. He comes back up and we find out that they've got about 10 messages each from Earth and they've been down there for 23 years.
Yeah.
And when that happened, the only thing that even made me remotely care about the relationship between Cooper and his daughter was McConaughey.
Yeah, because he's a damn good actor. Yeah. He can sell anything.
Aside from that, I really didn't care about that relationship at all. And for a film that kind of sells itself on being a sci-fi epic, which it wasn't, the backstory was the love between the father and the daughter, and they just didn't make me care about it.
And the girl who played Murph as a youngster, Mackenzie Foy, was actually really good.
Yeah, she was.
In and of herself, but there wasn't enough material to play. As we say, there was a lot of bump at the start of him going to her parents' evening and worrying about her having a fight over a textbook, but there wasn't enough of how much of a wrench it was for him to leave her. Because as Mark says, he comes home after the meeting with NASA, hugs the girl for 10 seconds, then 2 minutes later he's in space.
Just picking up on what Adam said then about the video scene, actually, this has just triggered a thought. I remember him going back and, like you said, that, oh, you got 10 each, you know, brilliant. I thought we'd get to see a few of them. He's looking at the first video of his kid, who's probably about 15 and 12, and he's saying, I'm looking after her, you know, everything's going well. The next video clip he sees, he goes, right, is suddenly a 30-year-old with a kid, 30-year-old granddad. Yeah. It's like, did you forget to record any other videos for 20 years?
Did you not record anything in that time?
I haven't done for a while. I haven't sent a message to my dad. But yeah, it's been 20 years.
I think that was indicative of the passage of time wasn't done well at all. Like,
no.
The scene you've spoken about, Adam, about how they went down to that planet and the hour or two they were down there equated to 23 years worth of Earth time. One of their crew, a chap called Romilly, played by David Gaiassi, he had stayed aboard the ship.
Yeah, to work on the black hole.
To look at the data and whatnot. So when McConaughey and Hathaway returned, he'd been there for 23 years. And the way that they showed he'd aged is that they put a couple of flecks of white in his beard.
Yeah.
And that was it. And then he spoke with a bit of a weird voice like that. But look, it's been 23 years.
Yeah.
It was rubbish. It didn't look anything like 23 years had passed.
I don't really know how to explain the passage of time in this film. It's like Mark just said, and you've just said it. It was non-existent. They estimated it was 7 years. Okay, science is wrong sometimes.
Yeah.
The estimation of 7 years turned out to be wrong for an hour. It was actually more like 20 years for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And McConaughey's performance when he finds that out is brilliant.
Mm.
So he goes and looks at these messages, and I think the worst thing is they kind of touch upon things and then never explore them. Like when he's listening to his son's message, the first one is, "Yeah, looking after the farm, doing well, Dad. Hope you come back soon." Then it jumps to a message where he's about probably 22, 23, the son. And he's like, yeah, we buried Grandpa today.
Yeah.
So one, you've not recorded the message in 7 years. And two, the only reason you've done it is because someone's died.
Yeah. And then there's another one where you see him, the son, has just had a kid. And then the next message is like, oh, I've just buried the kid. Oh, brilliant.
Oh, okay, fine. Right.
Mate, I hope you're having a good time up there.
Yeah.
Don't want to bring you down or anything.
Bring me back a bit of moon rock.
But I just didn't really care a lot about any of the characters. I mean,
no.
Michael Caine put in a good performance as Professor Brand, but generally, there was just nothing there to care about.
Well, the son we've just mentioned, as we say, the film really comes down to the love between a father and his daughter, but he also had a son, and the son was a complete cipher of a character, played by some kid whose name I don't remember as a youngster, but he's only in two scenes anyway, and then as an adult, he's played by Casey Affleck, but he has no agency, he doesn't do anything of worth. You could quite literally have cut out every scene involving the son and reduced that film by 20, 30 minutes, which would have been great for it, because it was too long.
I mean, I get the feeling that with the film, there was a lot of these points that we're talking about weren't touched upon, were touched upon, and then when they've got it back into the studio, they've realised the film's 4 hours long and had to cut out things.
Yeah. So what they should have cut out is Anne Hathaway's monologues about the power of love. That's what they should have cut, because that made me want to vomit.
I think it's fair to say, and we all agree on this, that film was an hour too long.
Yeah.
It worries me that we might get a Christopher Nolan exclusive director's cut at 4 hours for this, you know.
Four or five.
But maybe that extra hour's, that's where the story was. That'd be great.
It sounds like it's been an absolute masterpiece of a film with that hour in. But, I mean, looking at the story now, and, I mean, the more you think back on it, the more you realise it wasn't there.
No. Yeah,
there was no real story. And we'll come on to the ending in a bit.
And I think a lot of people come out of the cinema after watching that and they think, That was really cool. I really enjoyed that because visually aspects of it are brilliant.
Oh, it looks great.
And I think people are going to love that coming out of it. But I think if they give them time to think about it, they're all going to say, actually, no, that wasn't good.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen some of the reviews for it and they're very much a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm.
Some people love it, some people don't.
Yeah.
And I think it's literally, there is no middle ground here. You either love it or you hate it.
If you want to go to the cinema experience and you're not, you know, you just want to go and be blown away by visual effects, it was unbelievable. We can't take that away. You know, it was absolutely incredible. The direction at times were phenomenal.
And
you
the locations
showed, amazing.
They really earned their money on that one. Some of the locations they found were unbelievable.
The planet they landed on, the one I think it was where Matt Damon was, that they thought might be hospitable but wasn't, I think was filmed in Iceland. And it just had that sort of tundra look.
It was a great location to film on.
Yeah.
One of the things we keep reading as well with interviews with Matthew McConaughey and everyone, they are really trying to make a point that they didn't use any green screen in this film. And we were, you know, let's be honest about it, he could have done a lot of that on green screen. Like you said, he's took that extra time, he's gone and found these places, and that he deserves credit for. I came out of the cinema and I said to you, Ben, I said, you know, I really enjoyed that film. The cinematography was fantastic. I felt the sound design was unbelievable. I mean, I think the cinematographer, what was his name?
Hoyt van Hoytema.
That's the one. And, you know, again, the music by Hans Zimmer wasn't his strongest, but it left his mark.
I want to come back to the music in a bit. Let's stick with the cinematography for a minute.
But
the work by Hoyt van Hoytema was really, really good.
Yeah.
And it doesn't surprise me at all that you liked it, Mark, because Hoyt van Hoytema also did the cinematography for Her. And I know how much you loved the shots and the composition there.
And I said to you, you know, the cinematography was fantastic. The editing was unbelievable. And you simply said to me, but that doesn't make the film. And I think Adam said, you know, that's not the movie. And I forgot that for a second. I was like, you know, it's great. And then I actually stopped and went, the story was absolutely dreadful. I mean, some of the writing was awful.
It was awful, the writing. Just saccharine, sugary, lovey-dovey. Yeah.
From an industry point of view, as you've just talked about, you talked about kind of what we call the subcategories of the Oscars, I guess.
Yeah.
The music, soundtrack, cinematography, things like that. These are the subcategories, the visual effects teams, you know.
Yeah.
And this is probably going to take, you know, at least four or five nominations in these categories alone.
Oh, yeah, and it'll get some wins on the below-the-line technical categories.
And it fully deserves that,
because
some of that is brilliant. But we're looking at this from a purely film point of view. This is we're reviewing this for, you know, people that are going to listen to this and go and see a film.
Did we enjoy it? Were we entertained?
Did we enjoy it? Would we recommend it?
Yeah.
That's what we're looking at here. And we've talked about the story to death now, I think, or lack thereof, as Ben put earlier.
Shall we move on to talking about the ending?
Yes, let's.
Yeah. I was under the impression, so I think, do you want to explain it? Because you do it intelligently.
I'll try to. From what I could gather from watching it, towards the end of the film, Matthew McConaughey sacrifices himself for the rest of his team, or what's left of his team, which is just Anne Hathaway, and he goes into this black hole, and we assume that's to his death.
It's for Plan B.
For Plan B, which is to get Anne Hathaway to a hospitable planet. She has this tube of embryos where she can basically start a new colony. So he goes into this black hole, you think it's the end of him, and then he starts falling down what seems like a tube.
Yeah.
And then before you know it, he seems to be behind a bookcase, but this sort of weird 3D, spatially
concept
bizarre...
Time in three dimensions, I think they put it in there.
Yeah, and it turns out that the things that led him to being on this space mission, like in his old house back on the farm, his daughter thought there was a ghost in the house because books kept falling off the shelf and gravity was weird in the room, like dust would settle in piles in certain spaces. And it turns out that it was him in this, what I believe is supposed to be the fifth dimension in the future, behind this bookcase, sending her these messages. So she realises that, or the adult version of Murph, realises that he was the ghost all along, so he sent himself on this
despite
mission.
Despite there being no logical connection to that.
No, I mean, she just jumps to that conclusion because some dust moves. It's one of the silliest endings I've ever seen.
And it's really difficult for me to talk about this, because I'm a big fan of sci-fi, I'm a big fan of the aspects of time travel and things like that, I'm huge on that. And I really enjoyed the concept of this.
Mm.
What I didn't enjoy was the way it was put into practice.
Yeah, the execution.
The concept of having someone who essentially, I think it's called, a Roboros, I guess. It's kind of a circle of time in which your actions cause either you to do something. So him being in that place actually causes him to find a past version of him to find NASA in the first place and end up on this mission.
Yeah.
Which is a cool concept, and it's just executed very poorly.
Yeah, because they say throughout the film that... when he first goes and speaks with NASA, they say they have sent us these messages. They have put this black hole out
and
there.
And they turns out to be him.
Turns out to be him and future humans who developed this technology to live in five dimensions rather than three. And it's on paper, it's lovely, hard sci-fi. But in practice, it was all linked to his love for his daughter and her jumping to conclusions that because a watch ticked in a certain way and a bit of dust moved, that her dad did it.
Now,
it doesn't make a lick of sense.
I still maintain that this could have worked if we'd cared about that relationship a bit more.
I just wish they hadn't. I just wish they didn't kind of. And this is kind of Inception thing again. I just wish they didn't do that pretentious ending and that whole. Oh, some of the public will get one perspective of this, and someone else will think something else, and maybe the thing on the meant one thing. And I just wish they hadn't done that. Do you know, I wish that he'd gone down that black hole, died.
Yeah.
But he went out the hero.
Yeah.
A bit like Armageddon. Do you know what? Just do that though.
Can't believe you're comparing it to Armageddon.
But why not do that? Why not just. Be too Nolan and too pretentious and have this ending where people then...
sacrifice his life to not only save Brand, who's Anne Hathaway's character, and the future of the human race, but also in doing that, sent the data back to his daughter to allow him to save everyone on Earth.
Comes out the hero.
That was something I had a problem with, actually. One of the things he does when he's in this fifth dimension behind the bookcase... like a borrower, is he sends this data through that they've collected.
Compared to the
borrowers in Narnia.
This data that they've collected from the black hole, this complex astrophysical data, he manages to send through to the past to his daughter in Morse code.
Yeah.
Because, you can translate complex astrophysical data into Morse. Sure you can.
I think the best thing about that for me was when he did that, it then kind of cuts to a bit of a montage scene where she's working it out, and she's then got about seven blackboards full of equations that she's got from this watch.
Yeah. He must be well bored by that point. Just tapping. That must have took... Tap.
Especially seeing as, what is it, like three dots is one letter.
Yeah.
So...
yeah. Because he's made it so that the watch, the hand of the watch, ticks, as in dots and dashes, to read Morse code. It's
he is
ridiculous.
Living in the fifth dimension of time, so he does kind of have a lot of time on his hands,
this
I guess.
True, yeah. Nothing but.
No pun intended.
That, do you know what? I don't know what bit of the illogical parts of the film annoyed me more, whether it was the astrophysical data in Morse code or the bit that a lot of them were drinking beer. If the only crop you have left is corn, what's that beer made of?
Yeah,
because they actually mentioned that wheat was the first thing affected by blight.
So what the bloody hell was that beer? That's what I want to know, Nolan.
Yeah, forget everything else.
Maybe,
tell us what
maybe
beer that is.
It's a such thing as corn beer. Can you write in, guys, and let us know that? I never actually thought about that until you mentioned it. We touched on the ending just there. It's a very weak ending as far as the three
of
us are concerned.
It's disappointing.
And it does appear to be a bit lovey-dovey and pretentious.
Yeah,
and we've talked about pretentious films before on the cast.
One thing before we go through the characters about pretension that I want to bring up is how many times did people in that film quote from the Dylan Thomas poem, that do not go gentle into the good night.
Yeah.
I think five times we heard that. It's enough. We
and
get it.
Michael Caine reading it once.
fine.
Brilliant, loved it. You know, that's Michael Caine.
Yeah.
But Michael Caine reading it again and again, and then it from another person. And then and even appears on a plaque at the end. So
too much.
So, okay, let's move on to the characters then, guys. So we briefly mentioned Matthew McConaughey. So Matthew McConaughey is Cooper.
I felt he was outstanding. I think he was pretty much in every scene throughout that film. There was not often that he wasn't there. For 3 hours, he was fantastic. Yeah. He had every emotion. He cried a bit too much for my liking.
Yeah, he was weeping all the time.
Bit emo. but no, he was outstanding, and he did remind me of the character he kind of played in True Detective. And I just loved him, and that's one thing I can't diss in this film. I thought he was outstanding.
Yeah, I agree.
He was brilliant, and we briefly mentioned it, sorry, during the review, how the only thing that really made me care about a relationship between him and his daughter and that passage of 23 years was his portrayal of it. He was sitting there, and you could visually see the hurt and the pain on his face. And I mean, McConaughey's been brilliant for about 3 or 4 years now. He's kind of had this, what do they call it, the McConaissance, didn't they?
Yeah.
When he first appeared in Mud, I think it was, it kind of triggered the whole thing. But he has turned into this absolutely unbelievable actor.
Yeah, and I think there's a fair chance he'll be nominated for Best Actor again because of this. It was a really good performance.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously depends on performances up until that point.
Yeah.
Of other actors. I mean, I think we've got quite a few sort of rumoured around at the minute, like Cumberbatch.
Cumberbatch will be nominated, Jake Gyllenhaal maybe, yeah.
But I think he deserves to get a nod for this. I think he did. He was outstanding. I can't say anything bad about him.
No, I can't either. And he is, you know, one of the plus points of the film.
He held the film. Because the film was so bloody long, if you wouldn't have had someone so magnetic in the lead, I could have quite easily have just left halfway through.
Yeah.
But you didn't want to take your eyes off him because he is and so good at what he does.
If you weren't reviewing it for a podcast.
Well, yeah, there's that as well.
You'd have quite happily left halfway through.
So, Anne Hathaway.
For me, Anne Hathaway always has this look of a stage school child. She was a person who her mum, at the age of 8, made her go to stage school, and she did ballet and did tap and did her big, you know. She was doing Les Miserables 20 years before she did it on film. And she just has that look about her. In The Dark Knight Rises, she didn't have that. She fully committed to Catwoman. I thought she was brilliant in that. But in this, she was just that stage school girl again that she so often is, and I didn't like her.
I've seen her in a few things. I do generally quite like her. I think she is a good actress. There's no denying she's a good actress. And you touched on it there with Selina Kyle, Catwoman in The Dark Knight Rises. She really was fantastic in that role. And she has had good performances, but this wasn't one of them.
No. And that, again,
I
didn't care for her. And I'll go back to that scene where she just talked about the power of love and how she wanted to basically derail their mission to go to an inhospitable planet because her ex-boyfriend was there, and about how maybe love was drawing her there, and can't you quantify love? It's not science. Oh, God, I don't know.
Yeah, because they were trying to decide between Dr. Man's planet and someone she was having a relationship with.
Yeah, Wolf.
And then it turned out that the one that she said was drawing her to because of love was the hospitable planet.
Yeah.
Which again was frothy nonsense.
Yeah, but you know, do you not agree that love is more important than empirical scientific data?
Well, obviously.
Nonsense.
but Brand as a character there was non-existent for me, and I don't think that's Hathaway's fault. I think that's down to the writing.
Poorly written character, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about Murph as well, the daughter. She was played by Mackenzie Foy as a young girl, and then Jessica Chastain as an adult. So we've mentioned that Mackenzie Foy actually held the character quite well, but it wasn't enough to work with, really.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Jessica Chastain. It's the older version.
Again, not a lot to work with.
There wasn't, was there?
No.
I felt she was quite good in the way, when she was doing the recorded video messages and she was getting quite angry and upset, and you could see that she felt so kind of let down by Cooper.
There was one moment in which she sent him a message on her, was it 33rd birthday or something like that? Because there's a point made earlier on, when she's a 10-year-old girl, that Cooper, as he's saying goodbye to her, says, who knows, next time we meet, maybe you'll be the same age I am. And then she gets really angry about that and says, you don't know when you're coming back, do you? And that one message she sends is actually very good.
Yeah.
She said, I'm 33 now, I'm the same age you were when you left.
Yeah, and I think, again, the writing let her down in that they tried to develop her character by giving her someone to play off, which was a character called Getty, played by Topher Grace.
Yeah.
And he was supposed to be like a doctor friend of hers who worked at NASA with her and potentially a love interest. But he was a cipher. He did nothing. It was an attempt to give her more, but it didn't do anything.
He's another character that could have been left on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, unless Venom turned up, unless the symbiote, which is what I was hoping for. That's what they were going to come back
the
from
sci-fi
space
epic, with. Yeah. Says that Nolan is tying this into Spider-Man.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, again, she was. I thought she had to do, she did well. but there wasn't enough of it to do.
There wasn't enough of it, exactly right.
So Michael Caine, Professor Brand, again, another character where there's not a lot there.
Yeah, but it's a standard performance full of gravitas from Michael Caine. Yeah. Another thing where the passage of time let them down, I think. You see him, and then you see him 23 years later, and he's in a wheelchair and speaking with a creaky voice.
He doesn't look any different.
There's no makeup. He's got exactly the same beard. At least change his beard or something, yeah. Or thin his hair out or something.
Well, that was the other thing that kind of got to me, because despite 23 years passing, no one seemed to have changed their haircut.
Yeah, or clothes.
Yeah, or clothes. It was absolutely mental.
Yeah.
Touching on Michael Caine there, the only thing for me, I mean, you're both saying he's really good for what he's done. I just kind of wish Nolan wouldn't use him for a while now, because I do put him as Alf. I do put him down, you know, he was Alfred and in Interstellar.
Is it Alfie Alien?
Yeah, that'd be good.
Good show.
When he's in Inception and now he's in this, I don't see there's that much difference in his character enough. And I know that he's an aged man and he's always kind of the logical guy that's always looking out for everyone. But I don't need him in another Nolan film.
I just think he's this great guy that Nolan uses to play a character that's going to narrate slightly. He's going to move the story from one point to another. He does that brilliantly. Like as Alfred does the same thing, his development of Bruce Wayne and Batman as two separate people.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he's the one that kind of tells him in The Dark Knight Rises when he's leaving, because it's the only thing he's got to stop him being killed out there. In this film, he doesn't really do much of that. He just explains that you need to go into space because the Earth's dying. And even, I think he mentions that your daughter's generation is going to be the last to survive on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just like a film without him in it now. Christopher Nolan do a film without him.
Yeah, and the thing is, Christopher Nolan will write these lines that in his mind sound really powerful. And think, who should I get to deliver these lines? Let's get Michael in again. Like, there was that line, I forget the exact wording, but it was something like, I don't know, man was not meant to on Earth, or meant
man
to
was
leave
born
it
on Earth, it was not meant to die.
That's it. So it's like, oh God.
But yeah, again, I thought Michael Caine, he didn't have a lot to do, but what he did well.
I felt bad for the character of Romilly, played by David Gaiassi, because his whole role seemed to be exposition.
Was he in it? I don't remember him much.
Yeah, well, yeah. All he did was turn up and give you scientific data. That's all he did. His was just a role of pure exposition. He hadn't got a character.
I think if you totaled up his screen time, it would probably last about 5 minutes.
Mm.
It's quite nice to see him on screen again. I haven't seen him in much for a while, so it's actually quite good to see him. I was like, oh yeah, him.
But that was the odd thing about this film, because the only things that were really in it for a long period of time were Cooper, Murph, Brand, and the robots. Tyres and Case.
The robots.
But this is a weird thing, because we have Doyle and Romilly, who are also on the mission. I think Doyle's killed off in about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And Romilly's just there as, like you say, the scientific guy who gets blown up, I think, in the end, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
There's no one really who's given a great deal of time.
What do we think of the robots, then? The main one was Tars, which was voiced by Bill Irwin. What did you think to the robot design?
The design was weird. I liked it slightly. It was something different. It's something I've not seen on screen before.
Yeah. They were sort of rectangular, but their bodies were split into four parts. So they had these moving limbs and they could run. They were very odd. I thought they were interesting, visually interesting.
I thought the voice acting and the scripting for those guys was really funny, actually. I quite enjoyed what they were saying and how they were doing it.
Yeah, I thought Bill Irwin was a really good voice for Tars. My only issue with Tars and his sort of humour was that it was basically Marvin the Paranoid Android from Guide to the Galaxy. Yeah. It was very heavily influenced by that.
I didn't like them. I thought the design wasn't realistic. I didn't think that when they were running, if there's one scene when they run out to try and, I think, a certain amount of time.
Space travel and black holes.
Yeah, of course. I didn't believe. I think they went to get Brand, wasn't it? She was trying to get back to the ship, and it was running with her in her arms. It looked terrible, and I was like, that wouldn't work. And I didn't believe it.
From a purely physical point of view, they could not work.
No. It reminds me of when I was at school and used to learn how to count. You had those multi-link little square cubes.
Yeah, yeah.
You put them together. It looked
and
like
you had an abacus instead of calculating your granddad.
But they were terrible, and I didn't like the design. I didn't think they looked good. And I didn't like the comedy element. I had people in the cinema laughing at some of their lines, like 95% humour rate. Oh, let's take that down to 80. This was stupid. I was like, don't try and be funny. Don't do a...
I don't know. I quite like the humour aspect of them.
That's good we're divided.
It added something different to the film that it really needed, because there wasn't a lot in it.
I just didn't take them seriously. It just seemed like a joke, and I didn't see them having a conversation with them. It was like them talking to Siri. I didn't like it. It annoyed me. I really wasn't. I didn't. You didn't need those robots in the movie, for me. Take them out. Another 20 minutes out.
I don't know why there were two. There was another one called Case. I don't know why there were two.
I don't think you even realised that Case got activated.
No, I didn't.
So Case didn't get lonely and had someone to hang out with and play PlayStation and stuff.
That's right.
But it's weird, I think the longer this review goes on, the more critical we're actually becoming of it. I think as we're breaking it down, we're realising that it wasn't that great. Mm.
Something we touched on a bit ago was Hans Zimmer's score. Too much organ.
I was going to say, I can't remember anything other than organ.
Yeah, and it was really intrusive. Like, the best sort of scores, I think, you hear them when you need to. Otherwise, they just bed underneath the film. Whereas this one, you couldn't not hear it. And it might have been because we were in a fancy IMAX cinema with overhead speakers.
Maybe.
Which is like one of the first cinemas in the country to have overhead speakers.
Was it Dolby Atmos?
Not like they advertised it six or seven times before we got.
But it was over. It was too much.
It was overkill. It was too much.
And that organ sound that was there,
it
reminded me of the organ song by organ donor by DJ Shadow. That DNA'd it all the way through the film, and it felt towards the end it was getting so loud.
It really was. I couldn't even
hear some of the dialogue, and I was literally sitting there going. That tune was... I think when I went to bed that night, all I could hear was that tune, and it was annoying. And normally, he has a lot of variety in his sounds, and stuff like Dark Knight, Inception, Hans absolutely nails it. And this one, again, maybe do a film without him.
I mean, I'll be fully honest, I don't like criticising Christopher Nolan or Hans Zimmer, but this film was wrong.
Mm.
And I'm happy to admit that. I mean, Nolan is probably one of my favourite directors of all time.
Yeah.
He is my favourite director of all time.
Has that not changed?
No, I've still got him up there.
He's in the lists, and it was just this was wrong.
What next for Nolan? What do you think Nolan should do next? My thoughts are, I think he should do a smaller film. He's done this, and then prior to this, Inception, and of course the Batman trilogy. I think he needs to go back and do a smaller film like The Prestige or Memento. Bring it back, roll it back.
I think there's a lot of things he could do now.
He could do anything. He's got a blank check in Hollywood.
He just needs to... I think take some time out and just think about where he wants to go from here. He could quite easily walk into Warner Brothers tomorrow and say, give me a DC film again. Or, you know, I've got a new sci-fi epic I want to do. I want Interstellar 2.
I want him to take some time out, maybe go to a library, get some books and read some stories again and see how a story can end. And maybe take some...
It's an odd thing to say.
He's frustrated me.
Nolan's been so brilliant for so long that this was always coming. There's always going to be a moment where he was going to do something that wasn't as good.
Last episode, I mentioned how his CV was perfect, and we said, oh, he's going to fall. We've cursed him. We shouldn't have recorded last episode.
Where would you rank this in his films? As you guys know, and I've said it on the cast, I've always thought that his least good film was Insomnia. I put this beneath Insomnia.
Well, you mentioned this is my least favourite. So if that's your worst film you've done, your CV's not bad.
Yeah, and I still think that holds true if this is the worst thing you've done.
Oh, this is beautifully, the worst
beautifully awesome-looking film, marvellously acted film. If this is the worst thing you've done, then you're still doing okay, even though it didn't have a story.
I still get the feeling that if I watched it again knowing what to expect, I wouldn't think it was that bad anymore.
Maybe.
But I've got this completely overwhelming sense of disappointment from the film.
Mm-hmm.
He just didn't give us the whole package, and I'm going to keep saying it. As a director, that was a really well directed film.
Yeah.
He's still my favourite director of all time.
Always disappointed. I think, didn't get the whole package.
Yeah, I think a lot of people can go to this cinema and have a cinema experience you won't get from any other film.
No,
his green use, to know that he didn't use that, was nice. A lot of people heavily depend on it.
So we've talked about Hans Zimmer. We've talked about Chris Nolan. We've talked about most of the characters now.
Yeah.
Little cameo, Matt Damon.
Yeah, I liked him. I liked him in his role. I didn't think it was necessary. I think that could probably have been cut out as well. But I thought he was good.
I'd say, you say unnecessary. It's a good point to make that, you know, these people were held up as kind of the heroes of Matt and NASA's generation because they all went out there fully expecting never to come home again and never see another human being again. And I thought it was an interesting character point to have him there isolated from everyone and show what that did to him.
Maybe so, but in a 3-hour film, if you could have chopped that 15 minutes out, it wouldn't have affected the film in any way, except to make it better because it's shorter.
Chop out Matt Damon, chop out Casey Affleck.
Chop out the son, both in his young age and old age.
Chop out the ending, let him die when he goes into the black hole.
You've got a solid 90
comes
minute
comes out as a
film.
Hero, 90 minute Hollywood. Get Michael Bay in. You know, let's make this just a blockbuster.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone want to have Michael Bay in charge of a film.
Did you ever even think we would have this conversation, even as a joke?
I'm looking forward to knowing that in the future we're going to go and review Kevin Smith's Tusk, and I'm really hoping this could be a more higher-rated film than Christopher Nolan's Inception, in Ben's opinion.
Come on, then.
Interstellar, not Inception. But anyway, ratings you've there. Said ratings, so let's do it.
Let's do it. Mark, go.
7 out of 10.
Right.
I'm going to give it a high score for the everything else that I've mentioned.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about in this film, as we discussed, and I don't want to give it too low a score because there are aspects of the film I like. The story was a bit non-existent, but the acting was great. The direction was even very good. It's just the writing that really lets it down. And I think if the story had been good, I mean, this could have been an 8 or a 9. But I'm going to give it a 6. There's a lot of good in the film. There's a lot of bad in the film. Mm-hmm. So I think a solid 6 for me.
As you guys know, when we walked out of the cinema, my one-word review was horseshit.
Yep.
My opinion hasn't changed much since. I agree with you entirely that it looks beautiful, it's acted marvellously, but the story is dull and dire, and I didn't enjoy it. It's 5 for me.
So 6.
So 6
it is.
There you go. That's Interstellar.
Last time I set us all the challenge to come up with a film that is absolutely awful, an abomination of a film, but that has one truly great performance in it. I think it was quite a tough one. I know that we've debated this in our own minds for the last couple of weeks, so let's see what you came up with. Mark?
Right, the film that I've chosen is Spider-Man 3.
Yep, terrible.
Which is absolutely horrific.
Is there a good performance in that?
Yeah, I'm going to go with Thomas Hayden Church as Sandman.
Now, we did say last week that this was totally on you. It's up to you whether you truly believe this is a bad film and a good performance, yeah. And that's fine. But you're going to have to justify the hell out of this, because yeah. The Sandman sucked.
I thought he was phenomenal.
Really?
Yeah. I believed in it. I thought he was a great actor. I believed him in...
You believed that he was made of sand?
The CGI on that bit was not against him, but as the character, I felt and believed it. I thought he was a good baddie. The film was dreadful. He was up against people like Venom we know how bad that was.
Yeah, but did he look good next to Topher Grace as Venom? I don't get this one.
I'm going with it. I like him as an actor. It's nice that I have an opinion. But but no, I really felt he nailed that role. I can't think of anyone else that could do a better performance.
He is a good actor.
Sideways, he's phenomenal. Yeah.
I just wonder, maybe he suffers from following on from Dr. Ock, who was a fantastic performance in Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, a villain in a Spider-Man film was always going to pale in comparison to Dr. Ock.
But there's nothing else in that film I like. I'll only go back and watch it for his performance. I absolutely hate Tobey Maguire in that film.
Yeah.
His emo little hair. I don't even like Kirsten Dunst in it. She's annoying. She's normally absolutely amazing as...
Mary Jane.
And I just... Everything about that film I hated. The wasted Venom, he stood out for me. I really enjoyed him as the backstory. I felt he gave it everything. And I can't imagine anyone else could step into that role and do any better. And I still associate it and go back to it and think, that was a good performance. He nailed it.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of see where you're coming from. I don't think it was a particularly strong performance myself.
No. It was a fine performance in a terrible film.
Yeah.
Perhaps the film was that shit. The fine performance to me... was maybe exceptional because the film was so bad.
You could well be right there.
If you're not impressed with that, I'm going to pull out the other one, which I knew neither of you had probably seen. I was going to go with Morgan Freeman in Dreamcatcher. So Dreamcatcher, Stephen King again. Yeah. One of the worst films you'll ever see, ever made.
Damien Lewis?
Yeah.
I have seen that. And yeah, he's
got Jason Lee in it. I think I've seen about half an hour of it.
Yeah, it's a dreadful film. The book again, by massive Stephen King episode today, but... is an absolute incredible story.
Well, if you like Stephen King, then please feel free to check out our MCM Comic-Con Expo podcast where we interview the girls from Under the Dome.
Nice. Morgan Freeman is pretty much perfect in every film he's ever been in. Again, I didn't want to bring that one up because I didn't think you'd even seen it, so I'd have been wasting my time talking about a film you hadn't seen, so I went with Spider-Man. I'm sorry I disappoint you both.
I'm
still trying to get my head around it.
Good. Well, that's what it's all about.
Mainly because you're wrong. It's subjective, but you're wrong.
Spider-Man 3 was a fantastic film.
That's not the bit we were arguing with.
Right, well, with Sandman being the first choice of Mark, I'll go with Tim Roth in Planet of the Apes as General Thade.
Yeah, I agree with you.
This is Tim Burton's remake. Absolutely god-awful.
It makes no sense. The ending makes no sense.
Just before you carry on, we have got Tim Burton here today for an exclusive interview.
I'm not saying that Tim Burton is a bad director.
With Johnny Depp and his wife.
But this film was just terrible.
Yeah.
If that Ben said the ending makes no sense, the film itself just seems to meander from one point to another without really any kind of plot line or premise.
Yeah.
But Tim Roth is fantastic. I mean, Tim Roth's brilliant in everything he does.
Yeah.
As a personal opinion. I've watched TV series like Lie to Me, he's been in, Reservoir Dogs, any time he works with Tarantino, mm-hmm. in fact, he just seems to be incredible as well.
Yeah.
Delighted to hear he's going to be in The Hateful Eight.
Yep.
So, looking forward to that as well.
Christopher
Waltz going to be in that?
Christoph Waltz, I don't know. But Tim Roth really, really hams it up as General Thane, but in a good way.
Yeah, but it's
a role that
needs.
Deserved a hammy villain. Yeah. He's so good.
Well, it's a film that deserved better. Really.
It's a film that deserved not to be made.
Yeah, exactly.
When you said a film that is dreadful, you pick probably the perfect, most dreadful film that I can think of.
Well,
it's probably worse than The Matrix 3.
I originally looked at The Matrix 3 to try and find a good performance, and nothing. I couldn't even find a Sandman average performance in that.
But that's a great choice, to be fair. And I've only watched that film once. I went to the cinema and saw it.
You don't need to see it again.
It's the worst film ever, and I'm never going to try and sugarcoat it. It was absolutely dreadful, and it could have been good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was excited to see that he was on board. They got some good cast.
Mm, definitely.
I think he used his wife in that film.
No.
Yeah.
No.
That is a surprise. Tim Burton makes some truly awful films, but he makes some truly great ones.
Yeah,
it's just a shame. You never know which Burton's going to turn up these days.
No, very true. So, I mean, that's my choice. Glad you guys both agree.
Yeah.
Although I'm not sure if I'm on the side of right now, Mark agrees.
So, do you think it was a better performance than Thomas Hayden Church's Sandman?
Just barely, barely.
By the skin of his teeth.
But then, didn't Sandman win an Oscar?
Yeah, but not for Sandman.
He's here today. Enter Sandman.
Can't get the rights to that.
Right, Ben.
Mine. I've gone for more of a comedic performance, and to be honest, I think I've made this. I've mentioned this one before. One of the people who, for me, is always the best thing in a bad movie is Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know if either of you have seen a film called Be Cool, which was the unnecessary sequel to Get Shorty.
I've seen Get Shorty. I've never seen Be Cool.
You're missing nothing other than a really good performance from The Rock. And it was one of the first films he did when he first left the WWE. So he'd done a few things like Walking Tall and The Scorpion King.
Yeah.
But this was one of his first big sort of Hollywood blockbustery type films. You know, well, people thought it was going to be big because it was the sequel to Get Shorty. It died on its arse. And it was one of his first comedic roles. And he plays this sort of gay bodyguard, and he's just so, so funny. I would not ever say you should go and watch the whole film, because
sure,
you would hate me
say,
for it, but
I'm sure
you can go and YouTube the bits of The Rock in that film.
Okay.
And he's so good. He's above and beyond everything else in it. So that's my one.
Awesome.
So we've had some come through on the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/skip-to-the-end. We've had Gemma Hurst with Garfield. Bill Murray is amazing.
He's got the perfect voice for Garfield, yeah, so I'll give her that.
Stuart Pickering with Brian Cox in Manhunter.
That's a great film. He's having a laugh, isn't
he? You have a laugh.
We've got Mark Walker with Going Out on a Limb here, but The Last Samurai. He thought that it was the last pretty much good film with Tom Cruise.
Never seen it.
Fair enough.
You've not seen Live, Die, Repeat? / Edge of Tomorrow. / whatever else they're calling it this week.
Another funny choice here is pick any Nick Cage film he's made in the last 10 years. His hairpiece will be the best thing in it.
Yeah.
This is a stupid one. Craig Donisorp, Truman Show. Crap film, but Jim Carrey pulled off a great performance.
Idiot.
It's a great film.
Maybe not idiot, but yeah. Stuart Pickering with Alan Rickman in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And James Woods in The Specialist. And controversially, Will Smith in I Am Legend.
Rubbish.
I hate the film and I hate him in that.
Yeah. Oh, he's just playing himself, as he always does.
I enjoyed the film, then I read the book, and now I hate it.
Do you enjoy all the product placement?
It's dreadful.
I enjoyed their Batman vs. Superman poster.
Oh, yeah.
We've had Janine Evett with Tom Hardy in Locke. Basically, it's a film about him driving down the motorway in a car for an hour and a half.
But I've heard it's a really good film. I've not seen it, admittedly, but I've heard it's meant to be really good.
And finally, Chris Quagmire, The Moon Sexual. Blatantly not his real name. Jumper, which says Sam Jackson and Michael Is it Rooker? Rocker?
Michael Rooker.
Both had minor parts and should have had more screen time. They were outstanding in this film. Hayden Christian should have pissed off, and Jamie Bell should have had his role absolute. That's not really answered. He says a dread. Oh, okay, he's given the credit to Sam Jackson.
He's given the credit to bit part actors.
Yeah, Sam Jackson, who had a career for about a month, didn't he? He was in everything.
He still is in everything. He's one of the highest grossing actors in history, purely because he's been in almost every film ever made.
And on that note...
Oh, thanks a lot for your suggestions.
Appreciate it. So it's my turn to set a topic for next week, so it's time to take away and give this some thought. I was sitting there today thinking about our discussion on sequels we've had, mm-hmm. really bad sequels and all that. So my question to you both and to myself is, what film deserves a sequel? So what film would you love to see the next stage of? So one of your favourite films, I wonder what those characters are up to now, or I wonder where that would have gone.
Yeah. Matrix 3, and hopefully it's just an apology.
So it'd be Matrix 4.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I like that.
But
yeah. Yeah, no, really good idea for a topic. I like that.
No, I like that as well.
Can that make up for the fact I picked Sandman?
No.
No, nothing will.
Still not forgiven.
You guys know how much of a big DC Comics fan I am.
Yup. Beep, beep.
And how much the other week when DC brought forward their plans and give everyone a glimpse of the future of DC's slated films, how much I just despaired reading it. So, interestingly enough, Marvel have now done the same thing. They've slated their future releases up to 2019, which is a year actually less than DC.
We're going to do it in 1 year less than you, so...
Exactly.
There you go.
So, thoughts, guys? Have you seen this? Have you heard about this?
I've seen the announcement and I've seen the list of films and their phase...
I mean, the big one is Captain America 3 Civil War.
Yeah. The fact the title's there.
Which we sort of knew was coming anyway, so that one was that people had already sort of geared up for.
The interesting thing about that title is, are they going to contain Civil War to one film?
I think whatever happens, the repercussions of that storyline are so big that they couldn't possibly contain it to one film. Even if the bulk of the story takes place, there will be things that happen in it that are felt in the subsequent films.
I agree with you.
Well, that's the topic sorted and the news for this event.
The one that really stood out for me, though, is that they're going to do a Captain Marvel film.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the talk about Marvel films or superhero films in general is how they've ignored the female heroes.
Yeah.
And if you read the books as we do, you know how many and how strong and how interesting the female characters are. And they've yet to represent that on screen. I mean, so to use Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers, that's a great, great way to go.
We've only really had glimpses of Black Widow so far. She's never had her own film. She's always just popped up in another film. Don't get me wrong, she's been a very strong supporting character since her introduction. And I think Cap 2 Winter Soldier really pushed her into the forefront of that supporting character role. But it's interesting to see them now going down a route where they're going to put their own female heroes into their own films. Black Panther stood out for me. We kind of knew this was coming. It was hush-hush rumoured. But to see it actually announced is a big step for Marvel.
Yeah, and the fact that they've already named Chadwick Boseman as the star, a guy who's a real up-and-comer. He's been in a couple of big sort of biographical films so far of a sort of a famous baseball player in the States, and also of
that's mainly what he's done, isn't it? It's biographical pieces,
and also of James Brown.
That's mainly what he's done, isn't it? It's just biographical pieces.
Yeah, that's been the bulk of his work. So it'll be interesting to see how he steps into this kind of world.
But the thing about Marvel is they generally always nailed the cast. They've always got it spot on. I don't think there's really been a bad one so far, if you look at their slate of films.
I think with the exception of maybe the Hulk films, which for whatever reason didn't quite work, although I really liked Eric Banner in the first one.
Or Elektra.
Yeah, I mean, but that was sort of before the official MCU,
that was
wasn't
before
it?
Before Marvel Studios was what it was now. They're generally getting it right every time now.
Yeah, I have a lot of faith in them with their casting announcements. I still don't think it's been made official that Benedict Cumberbatch is Doctor Strange.
But it's looking heavily towards that.
Which is brilliant casting to me.
Fantastic.
What are your thoughts, Adam, on the two-part, over 2 years, Avengers movies now? That there's the...
Oh, I mean, you pretty much sold everyone at Infinity War.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The moment they said Infinity War Part 1, Infinity War Part 2.
You know that's when we're really going to be getting a lot of Thanos.
I believe they also gave a glimpse at the press conference of Thanos with the glove.
Yeah.
And the stone's actually already embedded into it. So it's going to be very interesting to see what route they go down there and how that kind of plays, and especially how Civil War feeds into that as well. But it's looking like a
very, they've gone checkmate, haven't they? Already?
Very good, yeah. 5 years.
That's it, game over.
That is what it is. DC with their, yeah, their slate, that was them making their best chess move, and then Marvel came out and just went, checkmate. We've got you.
You can't say checkmate until the films have come out.
Yes, I can.
I can already now.
You can make a prediction of it. But
I think, yeah, of course, because we haven't really seen anything of the DC film.
We've only seen
yet.
Man of Steel.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Whereas the MCU has been built up quite successfully over the last decade or so. So I think odds are it's checkmate. But you're right. We can't know until you see it. You're absolutely right.
But I mean, they could do some move that just proves to be incredibly unpopular and it just starts to decline. You don't know.
No.
It won't, don't you?
It's highly unlikely.
Yeah,
I'd say.
Entirely unlikely they'll mess this up now.
But talking of good moves, something else that came out in the past couple of weeks was the trailer for Age of Ultron.
I've only just finished clearing up. that looked unbelievable.
We've talked about this at length between the three of us anyway, and how Age of Ultron looks like it's going to be the film of next year by far.
Yeah.
If we're talking about nailed on casting, James Spader as Ultron.
Yeah, Robert California as the voice of Ultron is perfect.
That is just, I mean, his whole voice over the trailer, I mean, just leaves you cold.
Yeah,
it's absolutely unbelievable. And already, what's a 2-minute trailer? You just, yeah. I don't need to see anything else now, just give me the film.
Yeah.
I don't need to see a next trailer in the international and the Super Bowl trailer, just give me the film.
I'm surprised they've even released a trailer, surely that's going to sell on the name alone.
Yeah.
There's no need for it. Here you go, here's one trailer, bang.
It's astounding though that the trailer for Age of Ultron is the most downloaded and viewed trailer in history, I think, now on YouTube.
It just looks phenomenal, doesn't it?
And it really
surely
does.
Now DC have got to get a Superman, Batman.
There's talk of it being in December.
They've got to do something.
Mm.
They do, and I agree with you there. They need to make a move.
Yeah.
They need to show at least something. And unfortunately, they kind of released their slate of films. Well, I say unfortunately. Fortunately for them, they released their slate of films before Marvel did, because if they'd released it in the same week, you wouldn't have heard about it.
We'll be sitting here in a month's time going, oh my God, we've just seen the Superman Batman trailer. Dawn of Justice looks incredible.
Nothing would make me happier.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the thing. You know, we can be a bit dismissive of DC, but obviously, Adam, you as a DC fan, and me and Mark really as just superhero genre fans, we want the DC films to be good.
Yeah.
Nothing would give us greater pleasure.
A superhero fan right now, you could not be any more happy, can you?
Even
at
just
all.
To provide competition. I mean,
yeah.
If Marvel and DC are both churning out brilliance after brilliance, you just want them each to be stepping up their game as they go along. And that's what it would do. But it just doesn't look like that's going to be the way it is.
I was concerned when I... because I love Avengers. Absolutely adore it. It's one of my favourite Marvel films. And I was concerned when they announced they're doing the second one. I did think, is he going to top it? Is this going to be... but already by the trailer, I have no concerns at all. I think it'll top it.
I think one of the things that people have said about Joss Whedon in the past, something that I don't agree with, but a lot of critics have said it, is that he's a TV guy. And you could see that in the first Avengers film. For all it had big explosive sequences, a lot of it was TV style. This is what people claim. As I say, I don't agree. But I think if people have seen the trailer for Age of Ultron, no one could say that about it.
No.
Scope and the scale and, you know, that, this is a guy who knows what he's doing.
It looks like the biggest project he's done.
Yeah.
And from the looks of it, Infinity War is going to be handed off to the Russo brothers.
Who've done a great job
with
Captain America.
With Cap.
Yeah.
How exciting is it right now?
Yeah.
It's just phenomenal. I mean,
Adam's got 5 years of just love, yeah. Just
wanking into comics. But at just the moment I saw the releases, like you said, there were some very interesting ones in there as well. It wasn't just the standard ones that we expected. We've not even spoke about Thor Ragnarok yet.
Yeah. That'll be interesting.
Which is after the second Dark World Thor film, which I very much enjoyed.
Yeah, me too.
They're looking to build on that whole franchise, so it'll be interesting to see where they go with Thor, especially feeding out of Avengers 2.
Guardians 2?
Yeah.
I'm very excited for that already, even though it's, yeah, was it 3 years away?
Yeah, 2017.
But you know it's going to be incredible.
But it's, I mean, Thor's the franchise that's kind of championed the Infinity Stone so far, so it would make sense that it ties in. Guardians and Thor could start tying in here as well.
Yeah, because in Thor, they got the ether, didn't they?
Yeah.
And then in but Guardians,
the Tesseract had already come from Thor 1.
Yeah.
We'd seen the Ice Cube thing in Thor 1, then we'd seen the Tesseract go back to Asgard.
Yeah.
So we'd already seen the Infinity Gauntlet in Thor 1. So Thor is kind of championing the Infinity Stones with Guardians at the minute. So those two are clearly going to tie in before the Infinity War.
Sure.
So, yes, it'll be interesting to see Thor and Guardians tie in, I imagine, for the Infinity Stones storyline to resolve itself before Infinity War. Because I presume the Infinity War Part 1 and Part 2, there'll be a slight build-up in Part 1.
Yeah.
And then all-out war from that moment onwards.
Now, I don't remember the exact dates, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the two parts of Avengers 3 are going to be released a year apart, is that
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, 17-18, yeah. Isn't it?
See, that's great. Normally it annoys me when films do that. Like, I know the Harry Potter films have done it, and I think they might be doing the same thing with the Hunger Games, last two films. Normally it seems like a bit of a cash grab. And it may well be, but to get to see two Avengers films in the space of 2 years, I'm sold. I'm happy.
And it isn't a cash grab. That, with, like, The Hobbit, he admitted he only wanted to do one film. They made it out of three. It was taking the mic. I think he just wants probably 5 hours film, and he wants two of that to be a complete battle, like you said. Just
I honestly agree. I don't think it's a cash grab thing. I think the storyline has so much to it that they need two films for it. Because they need one part for Thanos to completely just decimate the Avengers, and the second part for the Avengers to play the heroes and come back.
I never know that much about this stuff, and then when you guys start nerding off about it, I get so excited sitting here, like, cause I don't know the story, I don't know how it comes about. When you say they all lead into each other and the stones, I don't know any of this. I'm just like,
one thing that has interested me this week is Kevin Feige coming out and saying the Avengers lineup is going to be changed after Avengers 2.
Yeah.
So how that changes, I'm really looking forward to seeing.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a fair chance that Cap's going to die. Thor could well die as well.
Well, yeah.
I mean, or at least lose his power and someone worthy takes over the mantle. There's all sorts of changes. We're going to get people who are brought in. You know, we might see someone like Wasp and Ant-Man joining the team after the Ant-Man film.
Ant-Man film, coming out.
Ant-Man's next year, so yeah.
There could be a good chance of Wasp being involved in that as well. Yeah. But very exciting time to be a comic book and a superhero fan.
A lot to look forward to.
Okay, so we had the homework set for last week. Me and Mark both took on Silver Linings Playbook, and Ben, I believe you had one sent in by the social media.
Yeah, it was Mark Holloway suggested that I watch The Third Man, a 1949 film noir. The reason why he suggested it was because he knows that I'm a fan of spy films, that kind of film, but he knows that I'm also quite dismissive of black and white films, and this is kind of both.
Which is
so he suggested that I watch that to see which side of the equation wins out. And truth be told, the fact that it was in black and white really didn't bother me, because it was that good a film.
Excellent.
Mark Holloway, you've done very well.
It stars Orson Welles, who of course is an absolute legend, as Harry Lime, and Joseph Cotton as Holly Martins. And essentially it's about Orson Welles, Harry. He invites his friend Holly to come and see him, but when he gets there, Harry's dead. It then turns out that Harry isn't really dead, and he's actually a scoundrel, and he's been up to all kinds of criminal activities, and it's about how his friend finds out and how they deal with it. And it's a really, really fun, interesting film, as far as film noirs go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As well as the acting, which was brilliant, especially from Welles, the thing that really stood out to me was the direction by Carol Reed. A lot of the shots, the shot choices he made, were really odd in that they were sort of skewed at weird angles. And apparently he was one of the first people to do this. As I say, this came out in 1949. And at the time, a lot of the big-name directors around gave him a lot of stick for this. They either thought that he was an idiot or just not very good at his job. You know, why is this at this angle? Why haven't you done this right? They didn't realise that it was an aesthetic choice. And if you go back and watch these sort of thriller films now or noir films, you'll see
they've
these kind of angles
adapted.
Repeat. Even something like Seven used some of the same kind of camera angles that were pioneered back in 1949.
So a bit ahead of his time.
Yeah, absolutely he was, yeah. Again, as I say, people were very dismissive of him at the time, but the fact that it's been a mainstay.
They're still doing those now, and you know, it's all originated from that. Fair play.
Yeah, so to be honest, there's not much more I can say about it other than I would recommend people go and see it. Not go and see it, it's not on at the cinema, not anymore.
Build a time machine.
But if you ever see it, it is on at the cinema anyway.
Go see it, yeah.
Go and see it.
Yeah, I recommend it, I enjoyed it, so thank you, Mark, for that suggestion.
Brilliant. Excellent.
So, Mark, we had a Silver Linings Playbook, so I don't know, do you want to start? Should I start?
Yeah, I'll go with it. So, first of all, my favourite homework film I've watched in the 7 episodes we've done of this podcast.
Awesome.
Absolutely loved it from the moment it started till it ended. I was really drawn into Bradley Cooper's character. I'm going to go out there and say it now. It's his finest performance for me. I can't think of a performance that he topped it in. He definitely didn't top it in my opinion, American Hustle, which people rave about. He was unbelievable. And considering most of the film is him, he was outstanding. I didn't even know that Robert De Niro was in this film.
And he's brilliant in it.
And he is fantastic as his father. And this is the film that made me fall in love with Jennifer Lawrence. So this is not a dig, but she is being kind of shoved down everyone's throat in the way of you've got her in X-Men, you've got her in
Hunger Games.
Literally, she's been American Hustle in absolutely everything at the moment. But it was nice to see her in not so much of a Hollywood blockbuster.
Yeah.
And she was incredible in this, and she matched the performance of...
Okay.
I'm worried you're going to go, okay, I don't agree. But she was incredible, and it's impossible not to fall in love with her.
I want to get in on this, but obviously it was homework for two of you, so I want to hear Adam's opinion before I start.
If you hate it, I'm going to be very disappointed right now.
Okay, I mean, to be honest, there was not one thing about this film that I didn't like.
Excellent.
it was brilliant. I was quite surprised. I mean, I'd watched American Hustle, I thought it was okay, I didn't think it was brilliant. I kind of expected more of, not the same film, but more of the same, that I thought, oh, it's all right, but it's not as great as people rave about it. But it was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mark's touched upon Bradley Cooper there. He's not touched Bradley Cooper.
I would.
Not for the one to try.
Mark touched upon Bradley Cooper's performance, and again, absolutely brilliant. Robert De Niro, again, I didn't know he was in this film either. And wow, what a performance.
Something that I've discussed in the past is how David O. Russell is so great at directing his actors to these phenomenal performances. So you had Bradley Cooper, Jennifer Lawrence, Robert De Niro and Jackie Weaver, as well as Bradley Cooper's mother. And I believe all four of them were nominated for Oscars that year.
Wow.
And then he repeated the trick again when he did American Hustle. The four lead characters, I think, were nominated for Oscars again. He just has this knack. Whether it's all him dragging out these performances or whether he's just very good at hiring the right people in the first place, it's probably a combination of the two. But either way, it works every time.
Do you know what was really nice for me? The fact that De Niro went, for me, off the kind of... the respect. When he was doing Rocky and Bullwinkle and he was doing Meet the Parents 28 and stuff, it got to the point where I was losing a lot of respect for him and I forgot that this is one of the most talented actors ever.
I'd never lose respect for De Niro.
Okay, I was a bit disappointed. I was a bit like, oh, don't do this. Keep your CV and legacy where it is. This, for me, was so nice to see him do a serious role again and show that acting. And when you think about it, he's a dad that was pretty good on, he was big on betting, wasn't he? And obsessed with the NFL. And to see his kind of love again for his son and the way that he's there for Bradley Cooper's character. It was so good to see him trying again at acting, not just cashing in and doing this silly, over-the-top comedy.
And this is one of the things, like, Robert De Niro over the years has been nominated for Oscars 7 times.
Yeah.
A lot of them came in a short space of time, sort of mid-70s and then the 80s, then a couple more later on in the 90s. His last Oscar nomination prior to getting nominated for Silver Linings Playbook was Cape Fear in 1992.
There you go.
So that shows you how long it's been since he's had a really, really critically acclaimed performance. And you think of this guy as being one of the best of all time, and he truly is. But if you think that it's been 21 years since he last had a properly critically acclaimed performance.
Just to get that out of him again.
Yeah.
And Mark's already spoke about Jennifer Lawrence in this. And again, I echo his sentiments about her kind of being in crammed down your throat a bit and held up as kind of the poster girl of Hollywood. But she's brilliant in this, absolutely brilliant. And you do fall in love with her. And I found myself at times wanting to throw my TV out the window with Bradley Cooper wanted to go after his wife as opposed to her.
Yeah.
Because it was very clear that his wife didn't love him at all. And then there was this girl in front of him who they were perfect for each other and he just wasn't seeing it until quite near
the end. The fact that she fixed him, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
She's
like
human medicine was incredible. And she's just absolutely gorgeous in it as well. I'm not just being like, oh, she's really fit, but she was such a beautiful character. And any guy would dream to have that sort of person come into their life. And
there's a wonderful scene on her parents' doorstep as well, where someone pulls up to the drive while Bradley Cooper's talking to her parents, and he starts trying to come and meet up with her again. I think her name's Tiffany. And he keeps saying, oh, no, no, me and her are going out. And Bradley Cooper launched into this big speech about how she's a great girl, how she's damaged, and you shouldn't take advantage of that. She's a bird with a broken wing, I think is the metaphor he uses. And it's just these touching camera shots as well that you see kind of her up against the wall. You see through to what he's saying. And there's just some fantastic moments of direction in it.
Do you know what I really liked about this film as well? It was such a good feel-good movie at the end. So yeah. It had that feeling that I think the last time I got this kind of feeling was watching Little Miss Sunshine. So I was watching this, it still felt like a low-budget independent film. Even though you got one of the biggest actors in the world, it did feel like a real kind of low-budget,
yeah,
you know.
I agree. And that happy ending kind of thing there, it's so easy to do badly.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And the fact that when they went to the dance competition and they're announcing the scores and they get a 5.
And everyone's sitting there.
But the fact is that the whole family are there and there's all these, they all look like sort of gangstery people, don't they, with their shirts, and they look all like proper rogues and they're all there, massive gamblers, and they're all cheering and it's incredible. And I just feel like, good on you, good, you know, when they're dancing and they make a few mistakes and you really wanted them to get 10, 10, 10, but you're like, they don't need that.
This is kind of what I'm talking about. It's so easy to do this badly, this happy ending thing badly. Because he could have had it where they absolutely nailed the dance competition. They've got 7s and 8s, but they're not professional dancers.
No.
So that would be completely unrealistic and stupid.
Yeah.
But so he does it in a way which is like, oh, they're getting fun. And you've got these professional dancers next to them watching them get 4s and 5s, going, oh, that's tough luck. Oh, that's tough luck.
Yeah.
Not knowing that these guys only want a 5.
Exactly,
yeah.
They're over the moon with a 5.
Yeah, and they all start celebrating. And these guys have never seen someone so happy about getting a 5. But that's what I mean. It's so easy to do this thing poorly or unrealistically and stupid. And it will leave you with a sense at the end of the film that, oh, that's just a Hollywood happy ending. Whereas this just seemed a bit more real about it.
One of the performances in the film that I really enjoyed as well, even though it's a minor one, was Chris Tucker, who I don't think I've seen in the film since Rush Hour 3.
Yeah.
And I thought he was really funny in that.
Every time where he's back at the house saying that he's been allowed out.
Yeah.
And then the police come in to collect him.
And again, one of the things that stands out for me, and again, is a person I bang on about all the time, is David O. Russell. You've mentioned the direction there, Adam. One of the things that O. Russell is really good at doing is that he doesn't work in one particular genre. If you watch Silver Linings Playbook and watch American Hustle and watch Three Kings, they're all very different films.
Yeah, he's not a one-trick pony at all.
No, absolutely.
And you wouldn't know that
those films are by the same guy at all.
No, you would watch them, you'd think they were all three good films, but you wouldn't know it was one guy who was responsible for all of them.
We spoke about it with our director's chat. It's diversity, and it's something that not a lot of directors do.
Yeah.
Well, I was surprised when you voted him as your favourite, and it was
second favourite.
Sorry, second favourite.
Or third favourite. It was in my top 3.
Yeah, it was nice to be reminded of why you chose it, and I can start to see now. And I've not seen all of his work, but... Best homework I've had.
And seeing as I was quite underwhelmed by American Hustle, it was great to kind of capture this film in a way and see it, because it did make me think, okay, yeah, that I can see why Ben did put him in the top 3 now.
Mm-hmm.
It was a shame that I was underwhelmed by American Hustle, but this was a masterpiece.
Yeah.
So would you say this film is fantastic?
Or incredible?
Or incredible, what would you say?
Brilliant.
Either or.
Best homework yet, Adam?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, speaking of homework, me and Adam have got ours already. What have you got, Adam?
I've got The Mist.
And I've got Jaws. So, I think it's about time, Mark, that you reveal to us a deep, dark secret, a film that we know that you should have seen that you haven't.
That you haven't. I don't know, like a Beverly Hills Chihuahua 2.
He's definitely seen that.
I've not seen Taxi Driver. And
I know.
Yeah, that's it. Done.
Done. Homework. Taxi Driver.
Accepted.
And don't forget, guys, we've got a brand new website, skiptotheend.co.uk. Check it out.
So we've had some questions come through from Facebook, which is facebook.com/skiptotheend, and also Twitter, which is @STTEpodcast. Michael Thompson has come back and said, name the film you're most excited about for 2015. Now, I know you've picked up and said you're looking forward to Avengers 2.
Definitely.
But is there anything else that you're really, really excited about?
I would agree with Avengers 2, but I think it's January the 16th over here, a film comes out called Whiplash. Which we saw a trailer for the other day, and it stars J.K. Simmons as a drum teacher, and I think it's Miles Teller as a drum student, and it looks like a really powerful bit of work.
I remember seeing the trailer for this actually the other day, as you said, and I just at the start of it, I was kind of thinking, what's this about? What's going on here? And then by the end of it, I was sitting there, I really.
It looks incredible.
It does look good, and people are talking about J.K. Simmons being nailed on for the Oscar for the best supporting actor. So we'll see.
Which again is enough reason to watch it anyway. I mean, if an acting performance is that good, that people are already talking about it being nailed on for an Oscar.
Here's one for you. J.K. Simmons in Spider-Man 3 as J. Jonah Jameson. He was better than Sandman.
Yeah, fair enough.
Terrible. I thought it was Avengers 2, obviously. I'm not actually sure when it comes out now. I'm not sure if it's been put back to 2016, but I'm quite interested to see Assassin's Creed as a film coming out.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Especially with Fassbender signed on for it. He's producing it as well, apparently. He's producing it and potentially starring in it. I'm not sure, as I say, if it has been put back to 2016 now.
We've got Monsters Dark Continent coming out as well at some point early next year. We're all very, very excited for.
At the moment, I've got a couple, so I'm really looking forward to seeing the Mad Max film.
Yeah,
I thought the trailer. Right.
That'd be interesting.
I thought the trailer looked really exciting.
It was cool.
Yeah, very cool.
It's one of those films where I find it difficult to get too excited about, because it's one of those remakes that you can quite often flatter to deceive, and you come out thinking that shouldn't have been made. But no, definitely the trailer made that look really cool.
The only worry for me is that I think it's been sitting on the shelf for about 3 years. I'm sure they made it ages ago.
Really?
So it worries me that it hadn't been released yet.
Yeah.
And obviously Jurassic World. I think that could be really good. Yeah. I think that could be a really, really good movie, and I just think it might relaunch the whole Jurassic Park again.
Yeah.
There's small film coming out at the end of the year called Star Wars Episode 7.
I've not heard of it. What's that about?
I've never heard of it.
That might be pretty good.
If you're the director of that, please feel free to get in touch with us and send us some sort of press pack or something so we can read about it.
Yeah, and if we've got the time, we'll fit in an interview with him as well.
Yeah. If you want,
yeah, you know, we'll see.
Michael, is it Crichton? What's his new film? No, Michael Keaton.
Michael Crichton.
Don't you say that? Birdman.
Westworld. It came out 40 years ago.
Is Birdman next year?
Birdman's next year.
Yeah, I think it's like the 5th of January or something over here.
That looks very much looking forward to
seeing that as well.
There's a lot of good stuff coming next year, isn't there?
And Michael Crichton. What a great actor. Up there with Clive Warren.
Any of us?
Nah.
And finally, we've had Richard Kelly via Twitter. Who would you most like to interview out of anyone that's associated with film or acting on a podcast?
Ooh.
I'm going to go there because I've been thinking about it today. Christopher Nolan. I think I could talk to him for hours and just geek off on him.
For me, even though he's known more for TV than his film work, although I think that's due to change, Bryan Cranston.
Oh, that's fair. Nolan's a good one. Cranston's a good one. I think I'd go with De Niro.
Mm-hmm. Good choice.
He's done some of the best films I've ever seen. He's got such a long, illustrious career. I think he'd have so many stories to tell, and he's such a funny guy from the looks of it as well. I mean,
or Larry David.
Larry David.
Yeah,
I think
as a joint effort, we'd all go with Larry David.
Yeah. And anyone with kind of a good anecdote.
Yeah, you know, Larry,
Someone that's going to be around with a lot of good anecdotes.
If you have any more questions, remember, you can also email us at skiptotheend@icloud.com, Facebook.com/skiptotheendpodcast, and finally Twitter @STTEpodcast, and we'll read them out next week on the show.
So on the last cast, I set you guys a challenge to think about it for a 2 weeks, because this is something that really, really, really takes a lot of thought and justification, of one film you can see before you die. You've literally got 2.5-3 hours left. You're in a hospital bed. They've said they can find you any DVD.
I'd want a Blu-ray if I was about to die. Yeah, I wouldn't want crappy DVD.
I want 1080p.
They've got MediCinema. They can do whatever you want. MediCinema, they're putting it on big screen, surround sound, just to make you happy.
Are they not?
Because you're about to die and you're that important.
If I'm about to die, I think you said that was with Ebola. I wouldn't want them to be running around trying to find a Blu-ray of an old movie. Try and save me.
Well, no, they've already decided that you're done. You're done for. Yeah. You've got 3 hours
left. Especially
to
for choosing Spider-Man 3.
Plus, the UN have said they're not allowed to save you.
Oh, okay, because Spider-Man 3 is a choice.
Yeah. So I think the thing that's going to be interesting here is the justification. It's not the film that you actually choose. So, Ben, you can lead off.
Okay. The interesting thing, as you say, is going to be the justifications for this, why we've picked what we've picked. I've gone with a film because it has a certain amount to say about what life is and what death means. I've gone with Blade Runner. because of the whole scene that we've spoken about in a previous cast, Roy Batty's death, when he does the whole, you know, I've seen things speech, you know, his memories will be lost like tears in rain. And the fact that that whole speech is about he's a guy who's lived a life, even though he's a robot with a 4-year lifespan, but he still lived a life, he still saw things. And that means something, and his life is about to end. So I think it's a morbid as hell choice if I was about to pop my clogs for Ebola.
Yeah, you absolutely love that film. I do. It's
just a cool ass film.
If you're about to
anyway.
Die, you want a good film, so you wouldn't be like,
I think that's it. You want something good to go out on, and like you say, it's a great film for the fact it is what it means to be alive.
Yeah.
And it will kind of make you reflect upon your own life, your happy memories, things like that. So I don't think that's a bad choice. I think it's a good justification.
Which cut would you go for, considering there's about 8 of them?
Any of the ones that haven't got the voiceover.
Brilliant.
Bear in mind, you've only got 3 hours. Well, I've thought about this. I mean, this was my question. It's something I've always kind of thought about. It's always chopped and changed. But I thought for this podcast, I'd sit down for
3 hours.
3 or 4 hours and just really go through my own DVD collection, see what I actually owned. Because I could come out with something and then realise I don't actually own it on DVD, so clearly it's not that important to me.
DVD, I remember that.
Oh, Blu-ray, whatever. Jesus. I thought I might not even own it on DVD, so...
Clueless?
Clueless. How did you guess?
Mean Girls, just have a good tug.
No, I ended up going with V for Vendetta.
Nice.
Now, this is a film that I absolutely adore. And similar to Ben, it's kind of about what it is to be alive. Mm-hmm. And there's a few lines in there in which V says where, you know, ideas are bulletproof and you can kill the man, but you can't kill what he is. And for me, that's kind of a great reflection upon your own life as well. It's all about what you've done and how you've led your life. You might be about to go, but your legacy is always going to kind of live on in something, in someone. And it's just one of those films. It's got some great action sequences, a fantastic plot line. It is actually one of my favourite graphic novels of all time.
Yeah.
Even though the film isn't...
Not sanctioned by Alan Moore, yeah.
Sanctioned by Alan Moore or nailed onto the graphic novel in any way. I think the storyline differs quite a lot, really. But for me, it was the perfect adaptation for that on screen. And some of the performances in it as well. I mean, Hugo Weaving has done a fantastic performance as V, and you never see his face.
Yeah.
And that, for me, is just so brilliant. Natalie Portman, again, fantastic. John Hurt as Chancellor Sutler.
Mm-hmm.
Everything about it, for me, is perfect. Nailed on perfection.
Even Stephen Fry in quite a small role.
Stephen Fry in there as well. Another great performance. But I just think, again, the casting for that film was spot on as well.
Yeah, really good film.
There's some great little twists in there as well. I mean, there's a fantastic moment where V is talking to the two detectives, but he's in the guise of someone they were looking for who used to work at the Lark Hill Detention Centre, and he spins them this whole web of lies and allows them to connect the dots for themselves. And it's just one of those films that I think
it's a masterpiece.
If I was about to go out, that'd be it. And it's actually, in all fairness, screenplay by the Wachowski brothers.
Yeah.
Who did the abomination that was The Matrix 3.
And they're not brothers anymore.
No, which is weird, and I didn't believe that. And we're on Google, like,
siblings.
Brother and sister.
Yeah, who are going to be coming out with Jupiter Ascending soon, which I think we'll definitely be checking out on the edition of the podcast.
Yeah, definitely. So, to be fair, I do give them a lot of stick for that, but V for Vendetta,
brilliant.
The film I'd watch on my deathbed.
Yeah, I can agree with the justification entirely. Mark, what have you got?
I love how much thought and in-depth and I'm going out and it needs to be this.
You've gone with Jingle All the Way, haven't you?
No, I've gone with...
Santino Morella.
So, when I've been ill off school as a kid, not with Ebola, when I've been feeling down, it's my go-to film. Now, if I had Ebola and I'm on a bed and my skin's rotting and I'm about to go, I want to go to that place where I'm happiest, that my childhood memory film, so it's Tom Hanks in Big.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now... That film is also about, not a kid that's got Ebola, that'd be awful. You see that film, how he becomes an adult, you get his taste of being an adult, and then obviously reminded that life's also great as a kid. I can't think of many films that make you feel as happy and as upbeat as that movie. Mm-hmm. The fact he goes to the Zoltar machine, gets one wish, it's incredible. It's such a great film, and Tom Hanks in that film
is
outstanding.
I agree. And again, it's kind of about what it is to be alive as well.
Exactly.
In its own way. So,
if I was about to die, I would want to watch that film. I love it. I just love the 80s feel about it.
If I only had 9 hours, you could watch all of them.
Yeah. But
do you know what would be a great thing to do? to go to that toy shop in New York and go on that big piano. Oh, wait, we did that, didn't we, Mark?
Yes, we did. It was great. We literally wore, this is no lie, from one side of New York to the other.
We walked the entire length of Fifth Avenue.
Oh, was that when I couldn't fly out there because I was having a hair transplant?
Shut Baldilocks. But yeah, we had 5 hours solid walking in the real hot. Got there, ran straight upstairs. There's a massive queue. I jumped over the,
over the fence.
Got this like little three-year-old. Move out of the way. Got on there. Ben, take a photo. Done. Straight out and then walked all the way to the airport, didn't we? It was
I think you should tweet one of the photos of you on the piano. It's movie-related. It's definitely related to the podcast.
Yeah, I think you should as well. And you should also tweet out an apology to that three-year-old child.
Yeah, she's dead of Ebola now. So, do you guys like that choice of mine? Is that just
Brilliant film.
One of my favourites.
It would put me in a better mood as I was dying than Blade Runner or V for Vendetta.
I think we're all in agreement with each other. I think the justifications there have been great.
Yeah.
We didn't actually put this out on the social media this week, but I'd be interested in actually doing that just to see what everyone else would choose.
Yeah, let's see what people come back with for the next episode.
So that'd be cool. We'll get that put out on the social media, so send in your responses.
So that brings us to the end of another edition of the Skip to the End podcast. Thanks a lot for listening. On the next edition, we're going to be reviewing Nightcrawler, a new thriller starring Jake Gyllenhaal. We're also going to be discussing our top three animated movies of all time. We're also going to look at sequels that we wish would be made. And then we're also going to be discussing our homework. This time I've got Jaws, Adam.
The Mist.
And Mark.
I forgot. Oh, I'm going to be watching The Taxi Driver. So remember to come and check us out on Facebook, which is facebook.com/skiptotheendpodcast. We're also on Twitter, which is at STTEpodcast. We've now also launched a brand new Instagram account, which is skiptotheendpodcast. You can email us, which is skiptotheend@icloud.com, and the brand new website, skiptotheend.co.uk. Also, we recorded a special MCM London Comic Con podcast, which is available. On that, we have given the opportunity to win a signed Lizzie Bennett Diaries Mary Kate Wiles poster. We've been getting a lot of response on Twitter and Facebook for this. If you want to be in with a chance to win this, check out this special episode now. And we also have some interviews with Sol Rubinek. We have Tom Green, the director of Monsters Dark Continent, and also some of the stars of the movie. And finally, we also have some interviews with the girls from Under the Dome. So please check that out soon.
Yeah, boy!
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Yeah, boy. Lovely as a summer day. My chérie, amour, distant as the Milky Way. Skip to the End